May it please the court, James P. Sullivan for TDCJ. Following a bench trial, the district court ordered, I'm sorry, can you hear me, Judge Prado?
Yes, I was just wondering if you had a beard.
I do, Your Honor. I measured it this morning. It's about a quarter of an inch in length, actually. My wife would kill me if I shaved it off. I've had it since law school. Following a bench trial, the district court ordered TDCJ to allow an inmate to grow a quarter-inch beard in accordance with his faith. It did so pursuant to Section 3 of the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, which I'll call RLUIPA. The district court was procedurally and substantively wrong in so doing, and its judgment should be vacated or reversed. It was procedurally wrong because the district court failed to find the facts specially and state its conclusions of law separately, as required by Rule 52A1. And it was substantively wrong because enforcement of—
Did you give specific economic facts that could have been found?
Oh, we didn't give specific economic facts, but that's really not the nature of our Rule 52A1 argument. Our problem is instead about the conflation of what is the finding of fact and what is the conclusion of law here. So we wouldn't be here complaining about Judge Hudspeth's order if we're not complaining that he didn't say how many dollars were spent. What we're saying instead is that it makes it difficult for us as appellants to know kind of what target we're shooting at and what standard of review we should give, because as the maxim goes, you know, standard of review decides cases. And it was the problem of conflating the findings and the conclusions and not the problem of lack of dollar figures, as we stated in our reply brief. The district court was substantively wrong because enforcement of TDCJ's grooming code is the least restrictive means of furthering compelling interests in the economic and safe operation of Texas prisons. Now, if there are other questions about our Rule 52 point, I'd be glad to answer them now, but I'm content to stand on what's in the brief for that since we have limited time today and instead spend our time together on the RLUIPA point. No other questions. Okay. So in these RLUIPA cases, we representing the prisons will invariably tell the court what the Supreme Court said in Cutter, and that is that you should give, quote, due deference to the experience and expertise of prison and jail administrators. What we often don't say, but what we probably should, is why the Cutter court explained that due deference was in order. It's not simply because the people who run Texas prisons know the most about Texas prisons, although that's true and that's part of it. It's also because failure to give that kind of due deference would potentially run the RLUIPA up against the Establishment Clause. So it's a constitutional avoidance point that prompted the Cutter court to reject a facial challenge to RLUIPA under the Establishment Clause, precisely because that due deference that you give is going to make sure that RLUIPA isn't used to elevate accommodation of religious interests above other significant interests of prisoners, of the public, and of the prison guards. And so we turn then to what was actually said by our prison administrators and how they shared their expertise in this case. And their testimony at the bench trial in this case went to two different compelling governmental interests. The first was the interest in controlling costs. And as this court held in Baranowski, controlling costs is a compelling governmental interest when it comes to RLUIPA cases for the reasons that I've just explained coming from Cutter. The testimony from our TDCJ officials about costs was essentially twofold. There were two different types of costs, one of which really isn't even denominated in terms of dollars and cents, to get back to Judge Owen's question. The first of these costs was the idea that we were going to have to spend limited resources and use limited space within our TDCJ facilities to open new barbershops. There was testimony to this effect from the Deputy Director of Prison and Jail Operations, Mr. Stevens. That's in addition to the dollars and cents that are going to be spent on new clippers, new blades, sanitizers.
But there's no effort to quantify that, either prison by prison or per number of prisoners or anything like that.
That's correct, Judge Owen.
You just got your word for it. It's expensive.
Well, that's correct. You do have our word for that it's expensive. But it's not just a question of how much money we're talking about, but we're also talking about whether it's significant enough to take away from other interests that prisoners might enjoy. And even without putting it in terms of a specific dollar figure, the notion that TDCJ will have to set aside rooms that could have been used as rec rooms or prison libraries or meeting spaces or classrooms to now convert those into new barbershops, That right there is the kind of scarcity problem that's going to elevate the religious interest and the accommodation of that religious interest above other significant interests. There's a second, though, point which also would probably not be readily susceptible to quantification in dollars and cents, and that's the operational burden that allowing quarter-inch beards for religious prisoners would take. When we have a quarter-inch beard limit that has to be policed, TDCJ officials know from their visits to California, where they've recently started allowing, I believe it may be half-inch beards there, or maybe it's quarter-inch, but we spoke to them about policing those length limits, and it takes a lot of guard time.
This is all in the record about California?
Yes. There was testimony about how Deputy Director Stevens visited California and Florida facilities in connection with this and other grooming code litigation, because, of course, this is not the first rodeo for grooming code challenges that this court has heard or that TDCJ has heard.
The district court found against you on that, though. He said it's done in federal court systems and other state court systems.
That's right. And I think that it's important that we look at, well, so to address the point, the comparative point about other prison systems, Florida actually does have a grooming code similar to Texas's. The Bureau of Prisons doesn't, but the Federal Bureau of Prisons, but they're really not a comparable institution to TDCJ because although they have a large inmate population, it's differently composed from the Texas, you know, street crime run-of-the-mill murderer, that kind of thing. California is probably the closest and most comparable correctional facility system to TDCJ, but there, the fact that California has decided to make their prisons less safe doesn't mean that Texas should have to do the same thing. It would be one thing if California had solved these problems that we've identified and Texas simply refused to follow some kind of innovative solution, but that's actually not what we've done. And in fact, some of the testimony that was brought back by Deputy Director Stevens concerning California's experience was that they were experiencing administrative burdens in trying to police this quarter-inch beard limit. And then the other, operational burden is trying to rotate all of these prisoners through the barber shops. And so I think that this court has seen the comparative argument in other cases, like in the Iron Thunder Horse case, which rejected a challenge to TDCJ's grooming code under the RLUIPA. And we don't think that it really controls the day here either. Now, you're right, Judge Owen, that the district court did find against us after a bench trial, and I'd like to try to explain briefly why the district court was wrong about that. The district court's rejection of our cost argument was based on a comparison of the group of inmates who wanted a religious accommodation to the group of inmates who have a medical exception to TDCJ's grooming code, which otherwise requires clean shaves. There are two differences that make it much more costly to extend this accommodation to a religious group than to the medical group. First is the size of the group. We have approximately 7,000 inmates in TDCJ custody out of over 150,000 who have a verifiable medical condition such as pseudofolliculitis barbi, and I can't spell that. And that's an objective and verifiable way to get into that small class. By contrast, testimony from the Director of Chaplaincy Operations, Billy Pierce, at the bench trial, indicated that there might be more than 50,000 inmates who would want this beard accommodation, and it could even be more than that. TDCJ's experience when we've extended these religious accommodations to different faith groups shows that when we do that, we see a spike in the numbers. So to take one example, and there's testimony to this effect in the record, we used to have 23 Native American spiritualists out of however many hundred thousand we have. Then we started allowing peace pipe ceremonies after TDCJ facilities went tobacco-free. Today, I believe we have about 4,000 Native American spiritualists. Now, my friend from the federal government has said that maybe TDCJ should just get more serious about cracking down and figuring out who are the real Native American spiritualists, who are the real Muslims, who are the real Jews. That's a very awkward position to put the government in. And if they have any tips about how we can do that, we would be happy to speak to lawyers from the DOJ about it to learn more about how we could do that. But that would also be another cost of this policy. The second problem that makes it more expensive to extend the quarter-inch beards to the religious group than to the medical group has to do with the frequency of the clippering that we're going to have to do. And this is really where the district court, I think, went astray. The medical group is trimmed with what's called a triple-aught clipper blade. And for reference purpose, I've never been to a barber that has one. But essentially what it does is that it clips the hair down so close that it gives you the appearance of a clean shave, but does so without actually causing whatever the kind of micro-abscess formation is that can lead to infections. And so, and then they don't have to go back to the barber shop until it grows out to a quarter of an inch. By contrast, in this case, under the terms of the district court's injunction, Mr. Garner has said that he rejects any clippering that would take him below a quarter of an inch. So we're going to have to clipper him to a quarter of an inch, and we're not going to be able to allow it to grow more than that for the identification and contraband problems that this court has recognized in many other cases, also concerning challenges to TDCJ's grooming code. So we're going to have a bigger pool of inmates who want more frequent clipperings, and that's going to be incredibly costly. It's going to require just the sort of expenditures that we've talked about, both in terms of manpower and womanpower, and also in terms of using scarce space within the prisons to open new barber shops. So that's why we submit that the district court got it wrong on the cost argument. To turn briefly to the security argument, the real problem with quarter-inch beards is that they conceal the contours of the face and make it more difficult to identify prisoners. And this is especially a problem when crimes are committed inside the prison. So the easy hypothetical, and there was testimony similar to this from the Inspector General of TDCJ, John Moriarty. He explained that, so suppose three inmates are in the rec room, inmate one wearing a quarter-inch beard stabs inmate two, inmate three gets a brief look, but inmate one runs back to the cell, removes the beard, and then this complicates the efforts to try to identify the person when we take inmate three around and say, do you see the guy who you saw commit the crime? Or the guards, for that matter, because the guards don't know the inmates by name. There are too many of them, and they're rotated too frequently. And so the district court rejected us on this point as well, based on this finding of fact that I submit respectfully was clearly erroneous. I'm reading here from page 6 of the district court's order. He writes, or rather the district court writes, quote, just as the bearded man can change his appearance by shaving, the beardless man can change his appearance by growing a beard. That's true as far as it goes, but the key word that's missing from this equation is a rapid change of appearance. No, inmate one in my earlier hypothetical can't run back to his cell, squeeze really hard, and grow out a beard that will then hide the contours of his face and complicate efforts to identify him. So I submit to you then that that finding of fact about the beardless man growing a beard, I hope, will leave you with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been committed. And if it does, then that's a clearly erroneous factual finding that should be a separate reason to withhold our grooming code and the enforcement of the same against quarter-inch beards against this RLUIPA challenge. Just as happened, I should add, that this court did fairly recently in the DeMoss case and also in the Gooden case. If there are no further questions, I'll be happy to yield until rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Manning.
Police court, counsel. When I first took on this case, I realized that I had cultural barriers that I would have to overcome, some concepts. I'm not talking just about the potential for radical differences between religious faiths. I'm talking about the culture in my state, Texas, of upholding law and order, because our tendency, certainly mine, was to not interfere, to choose not to interfere with decisions made by prison officials about what rules were necessary to maintain order. And so not being a typical First Amendment, RLUIPA, RFRA-type lawyer, I had to ask, what is the basis for that kind of review? Who are we in the law to second guess or even evaluate the prison system's judgment that certain rules are necessary for safety and security? The answer to that is Congress decided that we must subject those rules to a review. And it did so through RLUIPA, which grants to prisoners much greater religious freedoms and protections than even our United States Constitution.
What does this panel do with another panel's prior decision in DeMoss? To what extent is that binding on this court?
Well, if the facts in this case were the same, if the record in this case were exactly the same as those in DeMoss and Gooden, the court might be able to look at the possibility of determining whether, as a matter of law, the prohibition of beards is reasonable and satisfies the RLUIPA requirements. But this court has already ruled in this specific case that on the record before it, it cannot be determined as a matter of law, but remanded this case down for a trial on the facts.
Well, DeMoss came out after that.
It did come out after it, but DeMoss and Gooden both were very carefully and specifically restricted to decision being based on the record that was before the court at the time. And in both of those cases, and I think this is significant, the prisoners were pro se. They represented themselves. The evidence offered by the government was not controverted. It was not subjected to rigorous cross-examination. There was no controverting testimony offered. There were no experts presented. And in this particular case, I submit to the court that if the court were to find that the decisions in those cases were binding in this case, then that leaves Mr. Garner with the question of what about his constitutional right to a day in court? Doesn't he have a right to present his own evidence, to try his own case on the facts? And because it's a fact inquiry and not a question of law, I think the court has to look at that constitutional question. Are we going to follow those cases because they are deciding this issue as a matter of law without the need to refer to the fact record, or were those cases decided on the facts? And in this particular...
Are you saying it's a mixed issue of law and fact?
It is either a mixed issue of law and fact, or it is an issue of fact. And I think that the way it was remanded from this court, it was remanded for a trial specifically stating that the question of whether the beard prohibition was the least restrictive means of furthering a compelling state interest was a fact question. And so based on, and not only in this case, but in other cases under RLUIPA, this court has held that it is a fact inquiry, is a fact question. And so it either is a question of pure fact, whether it was the least restrictive means, or it is a combined question of fact and law, which would require the fact finder, the judge, to apply the law to the facts as he found them. In either instance, those fact findings in cases where litigants represented themselves without counsel, where there was not a fully developed record, and the state's evidence was not subjected to the rigors of cross-examination, would be unconstitutional, a violation of Mr. Garner's rights to due process. And the record in this case demonstrates the value and importance of having counsel and of controverting the testimony. Whereas in previous cases, the conclusory statements of the government that the beard prohibition is necessary to protect its interests in promoting safety and security went completely unchallenged and uncontradicted. Through cross-examination and discovery in this case, we learned that there is absolutely no data, there are absolutely no anecdotal information, there are no studies, either in the state of Texas or anywhere else that the state of Texas can rely on in order to base those conclusions. So they're bare conclusions based on what admittedly may be sincere feelings of the Texas prison officials, but they also had to admit that there were no facts to support those opinions. The mere absence of factual data to support their opinions, I believe, frees this court from the obligation to defer to their judgment, because the case law only requires, under Cutter, due deference, not complete deference, but due deference. And to determine what deference is due, some inquiry into the factual basis for the conclusions is appropriate. It's not the same type of deference that the court might give to law enforcement or prison officials in a First Amendment or 14th Amendment case that's governed by the rational relationship test. In those cases, the court gives a high degree of deference to judgment of prison officials unless there are substantial facts showing that their rules are either not a justified response or a necessary response to a security threat. In this case, not only did we show a lack of factual data, but through the testimony of an expert, George Sullivan, there was substantial evidence that the fears expressed by the Texas prison officials are unfounded. And that's supported by the experiences collectively over many decades in the Federal Bureau of Prisons and over 42 other prison systems in the United States that permit Beards reporting no increase in or no decrease in safety, no increase in violence, no difficulties in administration. And they've also obviously been able to do so within the confines of whatever their budgetary constraints are. In addition to that, Mr. Sullivan.
Did they say it doesn't cost anything additional, or just we're willing to pay for it? I mean,
there was no evidence about the cost sensitivity of the other prison systems, so I can't say what the budgetary decision-making was in any of those prison systems based on this record, just that there were no known reports of problems among the other prison systems because of allowing Beards. In addition to Mr. Sullivan presenting the evidence of his survey of other prison systems, he was an experienced corrections officer and prison warden himself, and helped to write and review the standards of the American Correctional Association, which is an accrediting organization that the state of Texas has applied to and sought accreditation from. So that it certainly places the state of Texas's imprimatur on the authority of that organization. The model rules of that organization provide for complete freedom of choice in personal grooming, both hair and facial hair, unless there are justifiable needs to alter the personal freedom. And the only witness who testified about whether Texas's prohibition of beards satisfies that standard was from Mr. Sullivan, whose testimony was that it did not satisfy the standard of the American Correctional Association. So when we speak of deference, it certainly may be appropriate to defer to other experts in the correctional field than just those who are testifying on behalf of the state. And it certainly was plausible for the trial court in reviewing this evidence to come to the conclusion that wearing beards, particularly short beards, did not present the identification and contraband secretion threats that the state of Texas was worried about. Now, if I can move on to the cost question, because that's that seems to be the more the stronger point, or this point that the state wishes to stress the most today. The state of Texas conceivably might have been able to present some evidence of what it would cost to permit a religious exception to beards. But the state of Texas did not do that. The prison officials who testify, both William Stevens and I think also Rick Thaler, admitted that the state of Texas has not done any cost-benefit analysis to even determine if the net cost of permitting beards would be significant. In fact, they don't even know if they permitted beards and substituted beard trimming equipment for the disposable razors that they now issue on a weekly basis to the prisoners, that it's, there's a potential it could have resulted in a cost savings. But because the state of Texas didn't conduct the study, didn't even look at its own books and records or present any evidence of costs other than the fact that clippers cost $34 and one disposable razor costs 4 cents, we don't know. And what the district court's fact-finding was on cost is the state failed to demonstrate. It failed to satisfy its burden to prove that the costs of providing an exception would be significant. And on this record, the state in its briefing and even in its oral argument cannot point to any evidence to demonstrate that it would indeed be a significant cost, or that after balancing the cost savings using different methods of complying with the court's order, whether there would even be a cost or whether there would be a net savings in cost. If there are no other questions, I thank the court very much for its attention.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wang.
Thank you, Your Honor. Christopher Wang on behalf of the United States' amicus curiae, supporting appellee and urging affirmance. I would like to focus on 2 points related to issues raised by appellant's counsel. The first is a legal point. The controlling costs standing alone is not a compelling governmental interest. Instead, the TDCJ must show that the additional cost of accommodating Garner's religious exercise is so excessive that it significantly affects compelling interests in security or inmate health. This standard is most consistent with the text of our LUPA, which states that our LUPA may require a government to expend resources in its own operations to avoid imposing a substantial burden. It is also most consistent with what the Supreme Court said in Cutter, which is that an accommodation must be measured to avoid overriding other significant interests. In fact, I think, if I heard correctly, I think appellant's counsel sort of tacitly acknowledged this standard when he said that the additional costs must be significant enough to take away other interests, such as a rec room being converted into a barbershop. The second point I'd like to make is a factual one, which is that there's a complete failure of proof by the state on what the cost could be. This goes to the due deference point raised by appellant's counsel. Now, there is a due deference standard in our LUPA, but this court recognized in Freeman that the least restrictive standard of our LUPA is a more challenging standard for prison regulations than the familiar reasonably related to legitimate penological interest standard under the First Amendment. These two standards would be collapsed together if we just rubber stamped the judgment of the prison administrator based on his say-so, which occurred in this particular case. There has to be some evidentiary support for the judgment of the prison administrator. And in this case, as Judge Owen recognized, there's absolutely no attempt to quantify the cost in this case. The record lacks evidence of how feasible and costly it would be to accommodate the religious exemption for a quarter-inch beard, and lacks evidence of any significant cost problems that beards cause prison systems that allow them. This failure of proof is particularly glaring because the TDCJ possessed evidence of the cost of clipper-shaving inmates with a medical exemption, but didn't introduce it. Indeed, over 40 state prison systems in the Federal Bureau of Prisons allow trim beards similar to the one Garner is seeking, either as a matter of course or for religious reasons. I would like to now turn to defendant's concern about sincerity testing. The Supreme Court in Arlupa, in Cutter, empowered the prisons to question sincerity of an inmate's faith in the Arlupa context, thus lowering of the rate of opportunistic conversion. Now, we acknowledge that sincerity testing is going to be a challenging task. I think Billy Pierce at trial pointed out several ways that that could be done. He suggested looking at the attendance at religious services, whether the inmate suffers because of his faith. I would also suggest perhaps looking at whether the inmate has engaged in activities that are inconsistent with his faith. No, I mean, we're going to...
hope that's not the test.
Well, if for example, if an inmate claims to be Jewish and to keep kosher and then engages in activity inconsistent with the Jewish faith by, say, working on a Shabbat, I think that would certainly be an example of evidence in which we might say that an inmate was not sincere about his faith. And this is going to be a challenging task. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But this is not an issue that's unique to the TDCJ. I mean, we have a lot of basically every prison faces the challenge of sincerity testing. And the vast majority of these prisons do not view this as an obstacle precluding beards. I'd like to turn now to the identification issue. Just as
Counsel,
with...
Counsel, would you address as to whether we're bound by DeMoss or Gooden case, or those bind this court to have to follow those decisions?
I don't think so, Your Honor. In both DeMoss and Gooden, this court affirmed as not clearly erroneous the district court's factual findings that the beard policy was the least restrictive means of advancing a compelling interest. In this case, the district court came out the other way. Neither Gooden nor DeMoss said that as a matter of law, a prisoner cannot bring a suit under RLUIPA challenging the ban on beards. In fact, there was a subsequent case called Alley versus Quartermain in which this court remanded a challenge to the beard policy under RLUIPA for consideration of the prisoner's suggested alternative.
So do we try this every time a prisoner brings the claim, we retry it and look at the record anew?
Well, I think by nature, is going to be a very fact-intensive intensive project. I think that the TDCJ is going to be introducing probably similar evidence in these cases, so I think that's going to relieve a little bit of the burden on courts. I think that the bottom line is that the TDCJ has to introduce some kind of evidence to support its policies. Some evidence showing the cost of the additional, the alleged additional barbershops and clippers that are going to be needed. Some sort of evidence that it's going to be more difficult to identify prisoners and it's going to cause a security risk other than their say-so. And basically what we're asking is just for the TDCJ to be sort of put to the test that's sort of set forth in RLUIPA's legislative history. Turning very briefly to the identification issue. Again, here, the record lacks any documentation in the form of studies or incidents of security problems that trim beards would cause. The record evidence instead indicates the vast majority of state prison systems and the federal BOP allow trim beards similar to the one Garner is seeking, and that the grooming policy imposes no similar limitations on inmate hairstyles. I know appellant's counsel raised a specter of an inmate shaving off his beard, which hides the contours of his face, but I would submit that a hairstyle covers more of the contours of an inmate's head than the beard covers of his face, and there's no prohibition against shaving an inmate's head, and that's going to establish as big of an identification issue. And yet the TDCJ does not ban the shaving of heads. In fact, the existing medical exemption for medical inmates actually rebuts the security argument because it demonstrates that the TDCJ does not experience any security risk for beards. I see that my time has expired. If the panel has any additional questions, I'd like to answer them now. If not, I'll just rest in the briefs.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. There's much to respond to, but I don't want to speed read through this because I've had problems with that in the past. I guess to start with the points by our friend from the federal government, there are a few problems with the things that they've told you today. The first is that it seems like they're really taking a very risky tack here by suggesting that RLUIPA should be interpreted contrary to what this court said in Baranowski and contrary to what the Supreme Court said in Cutter, and putting it at grave risk of being unconstitutional under the Establishment Clause. The second point that the United States raised that I think illustrates exactly what I said when I was previously at the podium is just how uncomfortable an inquiry it is for the government to be in the business of deciding who is a Jew and who is a Muslim. If the idea is that if you sin, then you're no longer that thing, then as Judge Owen, I think, correctly pointed out, none of them would have gotten into TDCJ's custody in the first place. All of us are sinners, but that doesn't mean that all of us don't have some kind of sincere religious faith. The third point that the United States raised, which is also incorrect, is the idea that shaving the hair on one's head is the better way to make a rapid change of enforcement, or rather appearance, I'm sorry. This is belied by the notion that when police show people mugshots, they show your face, not the top of your head. Now, Judge Owen and Judge Prado, with questions to both of my friends in opposition, really got to the heart of this case by asking about the DeMoss opinion from this court. It's kind of an existential question since we're talking about religion today, and that's how did we get here today? When the summary judgment was granted and this court reversed on the RLUIPA previously, it explained that it was doing so because although there was Fifth Circuit precedent on long hair, on long beards, on coupe locks, which is a little small patch of long hair at the base of the skull, there was no precedent at the time on quarter-inch beards. Now, of course, as a consequence of DeMoss, there is. But none of this was mentioned by the district court. Now, Judge Owen really did get to the heart of this, and that is, are we going to be in here? Am I going to be telling you this same, but I suppose maybe bolstered factual record every time somebody in TDCJ with time on his hands files one of these cases? I submit that probably we should not have to do that. And this court's precedent suggests that we shouldn't have to do that. Consider, for example, the Diaz and Longoria cases. They both concerned inmate requests to get an exemption from the grooming code on religious grounds that would allow them to wear long hair. In Diaz, which was under the RFRA, which was the same compelling governmental interest, least restrictive means test, Diaz, after a bench trial, said, no, sorry, you aren't going to get an exemption because of all the security problems it would cause to allow long hair.
What were the administrative issues in California?
The administrative issues in California had to do with, one, actually monitoring the length of the quarter-inch beard, and two, identification problems.
What were the problems?
The problems were, I think they described it as that it was essentially a hassle to have guards taken away from their other responsibilities to make sure. I mean, it's easy when it's a bright line. If you see either of our male panelists today or any of the people at the lectern except for myself, you can tell whether they've shaved or not. But once you start looking like me, if you had to guess how long is the hair, that's an administrative burden. Now, if I could get back to the Diaz-Longoria line briefly. Thank you, Judge Prado. Looking good. So in Diaz, this court, I couldn't hear it, but I'm.
It's hard to shave when you're on one leg.
Sorry to hear it, Your Honor. So after the bench trial in Diaz, this court affirmed the judgment that we didn't have to give an exemption to the grooming code to allow long hair. When we got to Longoria, which was an RLUIPA case, but the same standard, this court affirmed the dismissal of the inmate's claim under the RLUIPA without even demanding a response from TDCJ.
Well, my point is, the state comes in with a record, and wins on that record, then I guess if the prisoner can or the defendant can say, look, my record is different, I at least ought to get the opportunity, then we could talk about summary judgment in that context. But it does seem that you have the burden of proof here.
That's right. And we think that if nothing else, DeMoss shows exactly why we've carried that burden of proof. In DeMoss and in all of the other line of grooming code cases like Iron Thunder Horse, Diaz, Longoria, all of these cases show that testimony from TDCJ officials is not just some kind of post hoc or exaggerated fear. It's the best way that this court can have access to the accumulated expertise of the people with experience on the ground running Texas prisons. And DeMoss tells you that that alone should be enough.
Well, in that case, we didn't have evidence from other jurisdictions saying, no, but all these other people are doing it.
But even that's not true, Your Honor. In Iron Thunder Horse, for example, there was evidence of the policies of other systems. What there wasn't there and what there isn't here is evidence that they've solved the problems that Texas confronts. Mr. Manning has well earned the thanks he's about to get for having appeared as appointed counsel in this case. He has done an excellent job, and we're glad that our friend is here from the federal government as well. But his simple appearance in the case shouldn't change the type of evidentiary proffer that TDCJ has to make to avoid countless repetitive suits like this. So because my time has expired, we'd ask that the court vacate or reverse.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Manning, I don't have you listed down as appointed counsel, but
he's earned it.
Thank you. If you are appointed counsel, we appreciate your time and your efforts.